same format. You'll see your reading assignment, L stands for Laterette. You are not, when I, you're already behind, you are already behind in your reading. So that when we meet Wednesday, you will report the reading done for the introduction and for discussion two. Discussion one and discussion two. Understand that? Catch up. Give you the weekend. Work out nice. So we'll meet. We'll start the first section only has one. We'll begin the Lutheran Reformation. First section only has one discussion. Now, and you report your reading down, yes or no. You all know how that works. Anybody need me to explain that further? Okay, very simple, I guess.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand you. Would we have to have a discussion two by next month?
Yes, and the introduction.
And the introduction.
Two. Okay. Then you'd be down to one per day. Now, this class is very straightforward. At the end of each section, you'll be given an essay exam. Your final, as we did in our early Christian centuries, your final grade will be the average of your essay exams over the major sections. What was that? Set subject to adjustment by attendance and your reading. If you get your reading done on schedule, you do not get any credit for that. I do not give credit for doing what is expected. That's why I don't pay my kids to work around the house. They mow my lawn. That's part of living at my house. They mow the neighbor's lawn, they get $5. understand? Oh, but if your reading is systematically or regularly not done on time, it will adjust your final grade. And every quarter I teach, at least one or two or three students, that affects their grade seriously. Now, where it will help you is, listen to me. Getting reading done on time, often when I compute a grade, the difference, of, say, between a B minus and a B, or an A minus, is 1 point. And if we're right on the borderline, if a student has faithfully got the reading done, I don't mean perfect, but they miss a time or two, but systematically got the reading done, and a good attendance record, then I will adjust it up a point, understand, but only on a borderline case. So that's the only way, that is the small reward that might be yours. And I do that every quarter. As a student, they're borderline, they don't know either point, one and a half, and they've done that, well, then I'll adjust it up on that. But not serious, you can't go from it. If you make a B average, you can't get an A. Just because you got your reading done, because that's expected. Okay? Now, I will give copies of the essay questions as I've done before. Those of you who've been tested this way, everybody has probably. So you know ahead of time what you're going to be asked. And I'll just draw them when we come to the test time. Now, this map is. Here's the map we use for this course, year 1648, where we actually began before this period. Let's look at our syllabus. By the way, this course is on tape in the library. I think it's in the library, sure it is. I've got copies of it. So if any of you have to miss some lectures and you want to hear the lectures, if you want or not, let me know and I can tell you what tape numbers. Okay, that's nice. Say somebody got sick and had to miss a week or something. You might find that a real help in catching up. Because we don't cover a lot of things in class about the syllabus. And of course, much of our lecture explains the syllabus. We come now to the background of the Protestant Reformation. As you recall, this class is really a continuation of Western Civ II, early Christian centuries. We saw the pre-reformers. The two we think of are Wycliffe and Huss in particular. We saw the beginnings of the Renaissance. Well, we look now at the background, and we look at the survey in retrospect, going all the way back through the last quarter. In the first 500 years of its existence, we say here in the syllabus, the church conquered the Roman Empire. This was the issue in the book of Revelation. Who was going to win? pagan, Roman state paganism, or the gospel? Well, does the book of Revelation is right. In this great battle in which many died, Rome lost and the church won. I would point out that Rome is not here and we are. That is very significant. Ancient Rome is gone and we're still doing business very well, thank you. The church, and we said, first of all, the church was united with the empire under Constantine and his immediate successors. Then the church served the empire. And remember, we studied one section of our study last quarter was the imperial state church. And then the historic church survived the empire. Interesting that what we find that when the church began up till about the year up till the fourth century, the leaders of the church were Latins, culturally speaking, people of the Latin culture, the Church of the West. Now, you understand the difference. Here's the Constantinople is the difference between the break between the East and the West, the Hellespont. This is the East. This is the West. The barbaric tribe, the barbarians moved down, and the next generation of the church, I'm afraid that's simplified, were Anglo-Saxons, were Teutonics, were white-skinned people, white-skinned, blue-eyed people, were non-Latins. So we'll read, when we see Augustine, he was a black man of the Latin culture, but Martin Luther is an Anglo-Saxon. Saxon is in fact. He's a Saxon. He's a Teutonic person. All right, fans. Most of us. In other words, not Condolucci. Thank God, right? You understand that? And because these people moved down and took over. Now, we look at the period between 500 and 1500 is called the Middle Ages or the Medieval Period. Middle Ages means middle of what? Answer, between classical pagan culture, the Greco-Roman classical pagan culture, and the Renaissance culture of Western Europe. You understand that in Europe, when Rome died, and it died a slow death, agonizing death, a society, a civilization, a culture went with it. There was this middle period, the Middle Ages, and then around 1500, being very general, there was a revival of societies, of culture. Cities began to be developed, international trade, universities began to be developed. And Western civilization, as we know it, was born. What was in between these Middle Ages? Period of great ignorance, crusades, wars, death. In the center of society was not the city, it was what? Let me study this. The manor, feudal society. Okay. The Roman Empire disappeared. The Germanic peoples laid the foundation of modern Europe. The papacy arose as the greatest single power in Europe. Sort of a vacuum there. 1302, Boniface VIII declared, "Furthermore, we declare, state, define, and pronounce it is altogether necessary to salvation for every human creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff." This was the theory that was held by Gregory VII, Innocent III, and other significant popes. We studied that. But in the 14th and 15th centuries, there arose, and especially between 1450 and 1500, new national powers. No longer was it simply Christendom, but it is now Spain, and England, and France, and Germany. No longer would men think of themselves as Christian, but as a German Christian. And we're going to see this rise of nationalism when these feudal princes who became lords and then who became kings, when they faced the problem of how can I be a king if the church owns over half of my land, the land in my kingdom and the only source of wealth is land? How can I be king when my people's first allegiance is to the church? And the church tells them to do that which I don't want them to do. Who does that Italian?
remember that Babylonian captivity of the church? And the king of France said, look, didn't like what the Pope was doing, what did he do? He kidnapped the papacy and took it to French territory at Avignon, kept it there for about 70 years. That's pretty, and he said, that is, he said, the Pope's going to, if those Italians think they're going to run my kingdom, I'll show them. He just took the papacy, and from then on, during that period, they had French popes who did what he wanted. Well, you see, they would not have done that 500 years before. Okay, now, we look at these new national powers, and I survey them for us. Look, first of all, France. France had about 15 to 16. Now, keep in mind, these borders are were fixed later, understand? So this map is after I've written. Generally the same. France, 15 to 16 million people, doesn't sound like a lot, it's quite a few. Had a strong monarchy, it had been created, and France was the first nation where the king was able to overcome the power of the nobles and become an absolute ruler. Got the king, France was the first nation to have a king who really was a king over the whole nation. Absolute authority. What was the religious situation in France? The church was controlled by the crown. I've already mentioned that. The crown appointed candidates to the ecclesiastical offices. For instance, the crown decided who would be bishop, and the crown determined the flow of money. Kept all the money from going to Rome. Because Francis II, king at this time, controlled the church, he had every reason to oppose the Reformation. One of the great leaders of the Reformation was John Calvin. We're going to meet him as the leader of the second generation of the Reformation. What was Calvin's nationality? Was he German? English? Italian? French? Spanish? What was he? He was French. Frenchman. The University of Paris. Where did he carry on his Reformation? In France? No. In French-speaking Switzerland, Geneva, we're going to see. Why did he carry on in France? Why did he leave France? He asks, then he answers his question because nobody else is. He left it. French Protestants, the terrible struggles, the terrible time they had of it. Why was the French government, the crown, so opposed to the Protestant movement when it emerges? Answer, because they had a vested interest in the Roman Catholic Church. They controlled the Roman Catholic Church. They couldn't control the Protestantism. The church danced to its tune. And so they thought it was very nice. That situation continued to the French Revolution. So they had a vested interest. But there was in France a small but influential coterie of humanists who were concerned with going back to the primary sources. I mentioned Jacques d'Étaples, put his name here, for example, taught justification by faith a generation before Luther. And one of the things we're going to see, you're going to get tired of hearing me say this, but we say, well, the Reformation began with Martin Luther. No, it didn't, in a way. It did, in a way. Did the Reformation begin with Martin Luther? Yes. Did Reformation thinking begin? Reformation ideas begin with Martin Luther? Yes. Absolutely not. Listen to me. The idea of the Bible is the sole authority of justification by faith, those ideas were always around. They emerged in the person of great leaders who died, who were put to death. Wycliffe in England, and through his writings, John Huss, or Hus, of Bohemia. Bohemia's over here and here. Now, but why did the Reformation not start in England with Wycliffe? Why did the Reformation not start in Bohemia with Huss? They were earlier. Why didn't it start in France with the humanists, d'Étaples, who taught justification by faith? The answer is the political situation. We're going to see that. I'm not going to give you the details now, but you must understand that. One of the reasons it didn't start in Bohemia, and somebody give me a very good reason why John Huss did not lead a Reformation in Bohemia. not start the Protestant movement? Well, he'll answer that question, too.
The answer is, he was dead. Very hard to lead a movement when you're not there.
What happened to him? How did he die? Council of Constance gave him a guarantee
of safety to come and answer charges. And when they got there in Constance over in Germany, they said, promise me to a heretic doesn't count. And what did they do? They burned him alive.
Why didn't it begin in England, Wycliffe? Because conditions were not right.
That is, England had a vested interest in preserving the Roman Catholic Church. And things just were not... That is, if Wycliffe had pushed the issue, he would have suffered the same fate as John Huss. How do we know that?
Well, the Roman Catholic Church do it to the Council of Constance to Wycliffe.
Well, they didn't do anything. He was dead. But they did not that solve what they do. And they decreed his bones should be dug up from the hallowed ground from the cemetery, thrown on the River Swift after they were burned. Because as they burned, that was the punishment for heresy. Remember why heretics caused people to be burned in hell? So we'll burn them, the proper punishment. But since Wycliffe had the inconsideration, they left his bones burned.
Now, some of us can fall. See that? Why wasn't Luther burned? We're going to see why. But I want you to see, you must understand that the Reformation movement began in Germany, but Reformation thinking had always been around. And it was representing some notable leaders before Luther. He did not one morning come up with an idea that nobody ever came up with before. Not that he got it from them. We're going to see he didn't get it from Huss or Wycliffe. But the thinking was there, and we see it in France. We come to England, 4 million people in England. What was the political situation? Again, strong monarchy, strong centralized government developed in the 15th century in England. The War of the Roses had come to an end. It was called the War of the Roses because who were the British, who were the English fighting in the War of the Roses? Answer, other Englishmen. It was a civil war, and both of them used the rose as a symbol, so it was called, on their shields. Both of them had roses on their shields for reasons I don't go into. So it was called the War of the Roses. Henry VIII had inherited a unified kingdom. He was determined to preserve it.
Person on the throne, and so he was concerned. What was the religious situation? The church was controlled by the crown, not with the intensity or completeness or absolute. There was not the kind of absolute control they had in France, but the church was controlled by the crown. Why? Couldn't do anything about it. Initially, it's interesting, Henry VIII opposed the Reformation. In fact, the modern monarch, Queen Elizabeth, one of her titles, if you ever hear all of her titles, it takes about 10 minutes to list all of her officials, what she is. One of her titles is Defender of the Faith. What happens is, as different titles are given these monarchs, they just accumulate, you don't take them away. Well, this came from Henry VIII. He was called Defender of the Faith. Why? Because when Martin Luther began his work, he wrote a tract against Martin Luther, and the Pope gave him that title, Defender of the Faith, because he opposed Martin Luther. But later on, we're going to see Henry VIII breaking the throne for his own reasons, but they were not religious reasons, they were primarily political reasons.
What we're seeing that emerges is this, that if we had to give a one-word answer, which we get at, but if we had to give a one-word answer, to the question, why did the Reformation begin in Luther, in Germany, in Saxony with Luther, and not begin in England with Wycliffe the century before, and not with Huss in Bohemia, and not with the top place in France? The one word answer would be politics. Why did Henry VIII, who opposed Martin Luther, who was awarded the title of Defender of the Faith, later oppose the Pope? And begin the Reformation in England. rising nationalism. There was in England a vast amount of religious discontent. The Lollard movement, which perpetuated the teachings of Wycliffe, was still there. There was a great deal of resentment of papal interference in the affairs of England. The church was considered a foreign power, and the church was corrupt. Now, one of the things what we talked about last quarter, in detail, as we repeated here, that one of the reasons the Reformation took off was because the church was so corrupt. But hear me, it wasn't just the people we later know as Protestants who said the church was corrupt. Everybody said it was corrupt. Roman Catholics, then and now, in general, you got Roman Catholic leaders, then and now, have never denied the church needed to be reformed. It was in a mess. Note this, this is a repeat from last quarter. There are three kinds of corruption: administrative corruption, moral corruption, and doctrinal corruption. Now, were there attempts at administrative and moral? For those of you who weren't in the last course, let me explain the difference. Administrative corruption is where you have a bishop who doesn't do his job. He'll buy the office and then never show up, never live in the province where he's supposed to be bishop.
Extreme motion.
understand that?
So, now, and in England it was bad, but you see, in general, the doctrinal administrative corruption, the moral and administrative corruption made, listen to this very important summary statement I give, the moral and administrative corruption created fertile ground for doctrinal reform as well. And so we did in England. One of the reasons why the king, you say, well, if the Roman, note this, we've read this statement, the Pope claims absolute authority. Universal, absolute authority. But you have these king of France, king of England so far, who are in a sense saying, making the church do what it wants to do. How can the king get away with it? The answer is, the people, the nobles, supported the king, not the church. Why did they? Secondly, the church was corrupt. That is, if the church is looting you, keeping you poor, humiliating you, working against your general welfare, then you're going to find it easy to side with the enemies of the church. Right? Yeah, the church made great spiritual claims, but the church had lost its spiritual integrity. It had lost its spiritual leadership because of the corruption. It's like a preacher. You see, let me ask you, because you got an immoral preacher, does that mean the gospel's false? No. Doesn't mean what he preaches is false. But will he be taken seriously when he preaches? Will he be believed? Very often not, you understand? Even though a lot church is making all these claims to authority, but because of the corruption, people just didn't take it seriously. Enough people that these kings could get away with this. Such doctrines as purgatory and indulgences seemed to many to be nothing more than a clever device for raising money. There was. There was a strong humanist element in England. The humanists were the intellectuals, the scholars. The Vatican is there. It wasn't, never was. Spain was and is the most Catholic country in the world. You realize it wasn't until the 1960s that a Protestant missionary could even get into Spain? What was the political situation? This was the brief day of Spain's glory. She was the wonder of the age. Why? I'll tell you. Spain's navy, its wealth, the gold they got in. They made them the wonder of the age. They were the greatest. In 1469, four states had, by the way, it was Spain, not Italy, that sponsored Columbus. Isabel sponsored Columbus. Why? Gold. Anyway, 1469, four states had emerged. Aragon, we're going to meet Catherine of Aragon, Castile, Navarre, and Portugal. Portugal is still a separate country, is it not? Very closely tied to Spain. But these four states emerged, and then Ferdinand of Ferdinand of Aragon had married Isabella of Castile, and thus these were the two strongest, and Aragon and Castile were the two strongest Spanish states. Then Spain, in effect, was born in a strong central state. In 1492, the year Columbus discovered the New World, the Muslims were driven from Granada. Remember we said this last quarter? The Muslims had pushed in all the way up into here, and they got as far as in this area, and Charles Martel at the back. Don Quixote, see the influence of this period. The Muslims are very much a part of the story, but don't read book two, it stinks. Book one is good. Ferdinand Isabella in 1492 pushed the Muslims back to Granada, right here. And eventually they were to be expelled from Europe. Spain has been freed from the Muslims. Spain became, this was Spain's day. In 1615, Charles V came to the Spanish throne. Don't worry about the years, he's talking about the centuries. And eventually, Charles V of Spain eventually was to rule. Look at this. Not only in Spain, but Austria. Austria, the Netherlands. To rule southern Italy, Sicily, this area here, and eventually was to be the king of the Holy Roman Empire. So Spain was it. What was the religious situation in Spain? It was the great defender of international Roman Catholicism. Where did the Inquisition begin? Spain. We're going to see later on that the leading force in the Roman Catholic Counter-Reformation were the Jesuits. Ignatius Loyola.
Order of Jesus.
Yeah. He was a Spaniard. It was the Spanish Catholics who came to fight, roll back Protestantism in many countries. Well, I hope you get the point. The religious situation. Ferdinand and Isabella controlled the church in their domains. It was the Spanish who led the movement to reform the church administratively and morally only, not doctrinally. The Spanish Inquisition was instituted to ferret out and punish heresy. You see, understand this mentality. This Inquisition later was used on Protestants. And we talked about the Inquisition last quarter. You recall that? And those of you who need to go back and review that, and look at Barrow's syllabus. The Inquisition came to be used on Protestants. But it originally was used on whom? On Jews and Muslims. Why? Maybe on Jews. Because They said to the Jews and the Muslims, so if you either convert to Christianity, you can be baptized, or you can leave the temple. Well, the problem with that is some of them had been there for generations. It was their home. They weren't visitors. It'd be like telling a black man, off the... Enslaved, have been in America. You know, might as well send to Switzerland or
Timbuktu. Why Africa? We go to that. Who's in Africa? Send me China. You understand? That'd be like saying, what would it send you to Russia? You'll fit right in. Why? Your skin's white. And he said, well, thank you. But many stated, and like what I was saying before, the government would banish a Jew, but they would never burn a Jew to death.
Generally hold that the Protestant Reformation was unnecessary. Why? Because they say the church was going to reform itself. That's false, because the church got into doctrinal reform. The second reason is the Roman Catholic Counter-Reformation came to be based on force, not persuasion. And third, this reform movement, but this is not the Counter-Reformation, but this reform movement in Spain had spent its force, was used up before the Protestant Reformation began. Yes.
I have a question on this right here. Mm-hmm. If the Catholics knew that they were corrupt morally and doctrinally,
administratively,
well, they knew they were corrupt doctrinally too. Why wouldn't they?
No, they didn't know that. No, they couldn't admit that. You see,
they could admit that they had bishops who weren't doing their job and had all administrative corruption.
They did it out of ignorance. They didn't realize that they
No.
were.
Well, they could admit that. They could say to a bishop, you must live in your diocese. You got to straighten up. They could say to an immoral priest, you must be genuinely celibate. But they could not say, and you must not steal from the people. But they could not say, transubstantiation is not true. For instance, why? That came with the authority of the church. You understand that? So that was, they could not and did not. And never have, by the way. Now, read that, study that parenthetical comment, it's very important. Now we come to Germany, or the Holy Roman Empire, later called Germany, about 12 million people, which is the lower population, it's an area right here. And it was the grand exception. Now we're down to beginning to answer the question, why it began in Germany, why the Protestant Reformation began in Germany. What did you have in Spain? A strong monarchy, controlling the church, the Roman Catholic Church. Same thing in France. Same thing in England, not quite to the degree. In Germany, it was exactly the opposite. There was no king in Germany. Some of these states were composed only of free cities. There were seven of these states. We got that 300 different states. Some of them were very small, independent, no king, they could function. Everybody did what they wanted to do. There were seven elector states. Saxony was one of them. This is important to know. Saxony, where Jeffrey Luther was from, up here. That is, seven of these states, it's very complex, we don't have time to go into why, but seven of these states were their lay princes. They were called everything. A lot of other titles. But seven of these elected the emperor, the Holy Roman Empire. Now the emperor was a figurehead. He didn't rule. He reigned, but he didn't rule. But seven of these elected him. And they couldn't tax, they couldn't, they formed a diet, that is the leaders of the Holy Roman Empire of Germany, they met together in a diet, that was supposed to be the ruling body, king over them, but they couldn't tax, they couldn't enforce, they could talk, that's about it, couldn't enforce their edicts, they could jawbone and make policy, but they couldn't enforce it. Well, now this is important. For instance, we'll sneak a peek ahead. When Luther began to write and to preach, the king of the Holy Roman Empire and the Pope said to Luther's prince, a fellow called Frederick the Wise, outside of France. Why? He could not be protected from the king.
understand that? That there was, because of the decentralization, Luther, when if Frederick the Wise, his prince, didn't want to put him to death, nobody could make him. Short of having a war, which they eventually got around to. Okay, does that help? Does that make sense? I'm being very vague, but that's very important. Politics. See, we're back to this. What was our word? Politics. Wasn't that Luther thought something that nobody ever thought before? So Luther was in a position to stay alive, for one thing. Pretty hard to lead a Reformation if you're dead.